Well, welcome to episode 4 in our mini-series, Three Funerals and a Wedding. This week the episode is titled A Wedding and a Baby, or It's a Boy! Well, in case you've just joined us, this is the fourth part in a four-episode mini-series about the Book of Ruth. And let's revisit the highlights of the story so far, or as they say previously on Three Funerals and a Wedding. In episode 1, Ken Holt told the story of how Elimelech and his wife Naomi left their home in Bethlehem because there'd been a famine, and they went with their two sons to live across the border in Moab. Now, these two sons married two women from Moab. One of those women, as we heard this morning, was named Orpah, which Ken informed us should have been the name of Oprah Winfrey, except for the fact that her mother had rather bad spelling grades. The other Moab woman was named Ruth. Now, in episode 1 of Three Funerals and a Wedding, we have the three funerals. All the men die. Now, doubtless we think this is quite tragic, and doubtless it was quite tragic, but there would have been many people back at home in Bethlehem who wouldn't have been surprised that the men died. After all, Moabites were extremely unpopular people, except maybe in Moab. We discovered in episode 2 that there was a law in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 3, that prevented Moabites from entering the temple or having any association with Hebrews until the 10th generation had passed. And there would have been many quite unsympathetic to the plight of these women. You can hear them saying with self-righteous judgmentalism, "This is what happens when you have mixed marriages. It was your fault," they would say. "If you're going to allow Hebrews and Moabites to marry, well, God's going to punish you." Fortunately, of course, we don't have judgmental people like that around today, so it wouldn't happen. Anyway, with the three funerals over, Naomi decides to go home to Bethlehem, and to cut a long episode short, Ruth decides to go with her. And in episode 1, Ken asked us to think about the power of Ruth's love for her mother-in-law. It was the kind of love that broke down stereotypes, especially stereotypes about mothers-in-law. Ruth's love crossed borders between cultures. It was a wholehearted and kind of love that was for the rest of her life. Now, surprisingly, Ruth's profession of love and commitment didn't make Naomi happy. She wanted her name changed to emphasize how bitter she was. And of course, if Naomi had only spoken English instead of Hebrew, it would have been very easy for her to change her name. She would have just had to read it backwards. Because Naomi backwards is I moan. And so we went away for a week, and we all read the Book of Ruth from cover to cover, and we returned for episode 2, in which we discovered that nice guys sometimes do finish first, or at least not last. Tom Yardley revealed the surprising kindness of Boaz. Now, Boaz was some relative of Naomi's dead husband, perhaps he was a nephew, and Ruth follows along behind the reapers in Boaz's fields, and she gathers up the grain that they have missed or that they've dropped. This is called gleaning. Tom noted that something causes Boaz to notice Ruth, and he makes special arrangements so that she's well looked after. And Naomi doesn't moan about this. In fact, she's quite delighted, and she encourages Ruth to keep going back to Boaz's fields, which she does until the harvest is over. And then we went away and we read the Book of Ruth from cover to cover again and returned to see how Clyde Andrews would deal with the very exciting episode 3. But first, Kelvin asked us, what would Naomi be if Ruth had not gone back to Bethlehem with her? Naomi would have been ruthless. Got it back in front, did I? Oh, never mind. The title for episode 3 was A Special Midnight Meeting. which I thought made it sound about as exciting as accountants discussing double-entry bookkeeping. In case you hadn't noticed, episode 3 is more than a little bit romantic. Some might even say a seduction occurs. I mean, Ruth uncovers the feet of the sleeping Boaz. As Clyde said, you can imagine how Hollywood might have treated this scene. Well, if you were disappointed that Clyde avoided the Hollywood spin on this assignation, Clyde tried to get us to see that something more profound, something more authentic, something more enduring than mere seduction had gone on here. Something that we might label as love. The kind of love that is mutually honouring, the kind of love that wants nothing but the best for the other. And the way Boaz responds to Ruth's approach demonstrates something more than she had just caught his eye. And so Ruth goes back to Naomi with the news that she has been treated with great chivalry, not to mention carrying 6 measures of barley back to Naomi, which I reckon more than anything else would have killed the romantic moment. I love you, Ruth. Here, put this barley on your back. And so ended episode 3. What will happen next? This is episode 4. Well, since you've all read the book of Ruth from cover to cover a number of times, I guess you're not surprised to hear that there is a wedding and a baby. But before the wedding can occur, there's a little complication. It's a complication that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us in 21st century Australia. You see, in those times, inheritance of land was how one generation provided for the next. And we learned in episode 3 from Clyde that if a man died without a son, leaving a widow, his brother was obligated to marry the widow and produce a son. This son would be considered the son of the dead man, not the son of the natural father, his uncle. He would be the substitute son. The uncle would take possession of the land of the dead brother, and since wives and children were considered property in those days, the uncle would take possession of the women and the children too. They would become his family, and the land would become his land until he died. Then the land of the dead brother, that is the one who had died before, would pass to the substitute son, while the land of the dead brother, that is the one who just died now, would pass to the other sons. There will be questions about this later. Well, something like this appears to have happened here. Some relative stood between Boaz and Ruth. The relative had the opportunity to take possession of the land of Naomi's husband, and thus to take possession of Ruth as well. So Boaz does the right thing. What he does is he goes out to the city gate, which is where business was done. And by an amazing twist of clever plot lines, this fellow with the prior commitment, this next of kin, happens to pass by, and Boaz calls him over. Now, we never know this next of kin's name. Boaz just calls him friend. But there's a little joke in the Hebrew here. He actually calls him something that would translate more like so-and-so. So he says, hey, so-and-so, come over here. So Boaz explains the thing. The land's up for sale. The next of kin has first claim to redeem the land. And the old so-and-so thinks this sounds like a good way to expand his property investments, and says, I'll have it. And then Boaz reminds him that the land comes with some strings attached, namely a widow who is in need of a son and heir. Well, the so-and-so isn't so impressed now. He realises that the land won't stay in his family past his own death. It all sounds like too much trouble, and he passes up the offer. And to show he is confirming the deal, he hands over his sandal. As you do, right? Now, in episode 3, Clyde said we would hear about redemption today. And so we shall. This transaction in which Boaz and so-and-so took part was an act of redeeming the land. Now, the word redeem literally means to buy again. It's a Latin word, to buy again. When people went to war in the ancient world, if you won the battle, you got to take plunder. And the victorious army would take people as prisoners. They'd take them home. They'd put them to work as slaves. It was the reward of victory, or from the other point of view, it was the cost of defeat. But sometimes these prisoners could be released if someone would pay a high enough price, and the price was called a ransom, and the process of buying a prisoner out of slavery was called redemption. The slave was said to be redeemed. The slave was being bought again. Now, I guess I don't have to join the dots for us to see that this is one meaning that we attach to the death of Jesus. We often say that Jesus died as a ransom for many, that his death was redemptive. It freed us from slavery to sin and death. The death of Jesus redeems us from a life of sin and a life of separation from God. Now, there are two ways to look at redemption, two ways to look at the action of Boaz in redeeming the land and Ruth with it, because there is Boaz and there's a boy. Boaz and the boy. There are two ways of looking at the action of Jesus in giving his life as a ransom to redeem us. There is Jesus and there is me. There is Jesus and there is you. One way is to look at the transaction. What is it that Boaz does? What is it that Jesus does? Boaz swaps sandals. Jesus dies on a cross. But I said there are two ways to look at this. There is what Boaz does, the sandal swapping action, and there is what happens as a result, the outcome. There's a boy. Now, Boaz does a wonderful thing in redeeming Ruth. I'm not saying he doesn't, but the story could have ended right there. We may never have heard of Boaz and Ruth again, except for this boy. Because this boy is the grandfather of another boy. He's the grandfather of a boy named David, who would become the king of Israel. And this same boy produces a family line that goes all the way to the Messiah, all the way to Jesus. Why is it that we know the story of Boaz and Ruth? Is it because they are the great grandparents of King David? Did someone recall this story only when King David became famous? Was there some program like Who Do You Think You Are, who researched the history of King David at the time and worked backwards and discovered Ruth and Boaz in King David's past? Do we only know about Boaz and Ruth because we know about King David? Or do we know about King David because we know about Boaz and Ruth? Well, I think it's this second one. As important as Boaz's act of redemption is, what's more important is how Boaz and Ruth, and generations after them, lived in response to being redeemed. During the 19th century, over 1 million Irish people left Ireland to go to America, Canada, many came to Australia and New Zealand. They were searching for a new life, and they were leaving because life was very bad in Ireland as a result of British rule and as a result of the Great Potato Famine in the middle 19th century. One of those immigrants was a penniless boy who stowed away in a ship bound for America. And in the middle of the Atlantic, the ship hit an iceberg and began to sink. But it was sinking slowly enough that there was enough time for everybody to get off into the lifeboats. Well, deep down in the bowels of the ship, the stowaway boy was wondering why the ship had stopped. And so he came out of his hiding place and found that there was no one around. He came up on deck just as the captain was about to step into the last seat of the last lifeboat. And in the highest tradition of the sea, the captain stepped back and put the boy in his place. And as the lifeboat pushed off, he said to the lad, "Never forget what was done for you." As the lifeboat pulled away, the lad could see the captain standing on the deck, and that vision never left him. He became a very successful businessman in America, and when people asked him about the secret of his achievement, he would always tell the story about the captain giving his life for him and how he was urged to never forget what had been done for him. "Whenever I get discouraged and feel negatively about myself," he said, "I recall the vision of what has been done for me, and it gives me new courage to be worthy of such a price." 2 days away from Anzac Day, and lots of us are thinking about the supreme sacrifice, to lay down one's life for another. There have been many times during wars or disasters when that sacrifice has been made, and I'm sure one of the questions that pops into our mind is, could I do that myself? The other question I think we think about is, how could I ever repay such a sacrifice if it were made for me? Well, the answer must be that you couldn't repay it. It'd be impossible. But we would surely have a responsibility to take advantage of such a sacrifice, as did the young stowaway on the sinking ship. He went on to success, but he never forgot the price that was paid by another. He never forgot that act of redemption. How wrong it would be to forget that sacrifice. How wrong it would be to devalue it by failing to grasp the new life that was provided. And the story of Ruth in episode 4 is about Boaz and the boy. Boaz's action in redeeming Ruth had consequences for the way they lived. We know for a fact that this story of what Boaz did was told over and over again down through the generations. How do we know that fact? Well, we have it written down in the Bible a few thousand years later. The only way to explain it is to realize that Ruth, and probably Naomi too, told the story of their redemption to their son. This story of redemption and the obligation to live fully and responsibly in the light of that act of redemption, this story was told over and over. It shaped the character of the boy. It shaped the character of generations. It shaped the character of a boy named David, who knew from his great-grandparents how much his character was a consequence of one man's act of redemption. It shaped the life of the generations beyond King David too. They kept telling this story, mothers to children. The family produced kings. And finally, the King of Kings. You see, the act of redemption is only half the story. What Ruth did as a result of being redeemed is the other half of the story. The story is about Boaz and the boy. I've been managing in organisations, people in organisations, now for the best part of 4 decades. Every time I join a new organisation, I seem to inherit a certain kind of accountant. It's happened to me again this year. Now, this kind of accountant is one who knows the accounting rules. They work diligently to produce beautiful rows and columns of numbers that all sum correctly, left to right, up and down. And they know how to do the transactional stuff of accounting. In fact, if Boaz had been had one of these accountants at the city gate, you can be sure the accountant would have checked that the sandals that were swapped balanced. Let me reassure you that I want my accounts to balance. But that's only half the story. I want my accounts to provide information that helps me do my job. At the first board meeting I attended at Vicarly Food Bank, where I started in January, we received about 20 pages of accounts. Dozens of columns and rows on every page. No number bigger than 8 point. Beautiful piece of work. Completely useless. It's one thing to know the accounting rules, well, but that's half the story. The other half is what you do as a result. Fortunately, not all accountants are like this. I'm happy to report about my new one. Have you been watching Matthew Lloyd kicking at goal recently? Lovely style, great balance, good ball drop, nice follow through, can't buy a goal this year. Have you watched Buddy Franklin kick for goal? Doesn't run in straight, forgets to watch the ball onto his boot, curves the ball in the air, leading the Coleman medal count. It's one thing to kick well, but that's half the story. The other half is what you do as a result. Now, that's not in the Bible. That's John Kennedy speaking, by the way. Do something. It's one thing to get the transaction right, but that's only half the story. The other half is what you do in response to the transaction. You see, redemption is about what happens, at least as much as it is about what was transacted. Jesus gave away his life so that we might live in the kingdom of his love. The challenge for us is to do the same, to give our lives away. When Jesus broke the bread in the upper room with the disciples before his body, he gave the bread away. The bread that represents his body, he gave it away. And then he said, go and do likewise. You see, our celebration of Holy Communion is useless unless it translates into daily actions that show we live responsibly in the light of the redemption that has been offered to us. Worse, our failure to live fully responsible, redeemed lives is an insult to the one who redeemed us. Could there be a greater sin? We're called into daily acts of redemption. We're called to give our lives away in the daily work of redeeming a lost world. You see, the Christian life is not about the how of transactions. That's only half the story. The other half of the story is how we live as a result. God may ask some of us to swap sandals, if that's what it takes to redeem the world. God may ask some of us to sell all we have and give it to the poor, if that's what it takes to redeem the world. God may ask some of us to go and live in a foreign country, sacrificing our health, giving our lives away so that communities can be rescued from poverty, if that's what it takes to redeem the world. God may ask us to give up some of our time to attend a prayer meeting or to drive a senior citizen to a lunch, if that's what it takes to redeem the world. God may ask us to give up some pride or to show a bit of grace, or to hold our tongue, if that's what it takes to redeem the world. What will God be asking us to do today and tomorrow to live redemptively in response to his great love? Amen.